This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this week's programme, I'll be asking just who are the American far right and how important are they? It was a huge moral victory. That was how Richard B. Spencer, one of the leaders of America's far right, described the rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Last weekend, the sight of hundreds of men, many heavily armed, others adorned with Nazi insignia, on the streets of a usually tranquil city, shocked America and the world. It all ended in violence and the death of 32-year-old anti-racist protester Heather Heyer.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country. Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. I will tell you something. I watched those very closely, much more closely than you people watched it. And you have, you had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent.
One people, one nation, and immigration.
Today, I'm asking some very specific questions about the far right in America. Who is in it? What do they want? Is it a real threat to American society? And what should the response be? Step inside the briefing room to find out. First, let's look at who was actually on the streets in Charlottesville last weekend. We invited Sandy Houseman, local bureau chief of WVTF Radio, who was there, into the briefing room. She's lived and worked there for nearly 10 years. Why did all this happen in her town?
Charlottesville is really an idyllic city. I moved here from Chicago because I, like so many other people, was charmed. It's constantly popping up on lists of best places to live. We're about 3 hours south of Washington, D.C. We're nestled between a couple of mountain ranges and a national park, so it's very lovely. And it's also historic. We have Thomas Jefferson's home here. And, of course, we have the University of Virginia. Politically, I would describe this area as liberal. During the election, we had Bernie supporters and we had Hillary supporters and very few Donald supporters. That said, in our rural areas around Charlottesville, you do find Trump supporters and maybe some white supremacists. But frankly, we think that most of those who came here over the weekend for the Unite the Right rally were from somewhere else. I'd say the overall tone of the town is rational, well-meaning, even genteel, which is something Virginians are very proud of. In our state capital, Richmond, the politicians often talk about the Virginia way, which is all about discussion and compromise and mutual respect, things we definitely did not see over the weekend. People came to Charlottesville for a couple of reasons. First of all, we had a very active extremist blogger here by the name of Jason Kessler. And Jason was tooling around the internet and discovered some postings by the only African-American on our city council, which were racist and offensive to women. They were also posted some years ago. And this fellow, whose name is Wes Bellamy, is very well liked and quickly apologized for those postings, said that at the time he was living in the Deep South, he had very negative interactions with white people. Now that he's come to Charlottesville, he does not believe these things. But Jason Kessler, the blogger, was determined to get this guy out of office, and he began a crusade online and in person to remove Bellamy. And that attracted a lot of interest from alt-right people around the country. The other thing is that we have a very prominent statue of Robert E. Lee in our downtown area. Lee was a Confederate general. That also, I think, made Charlottesville a target.
This is an absolute outrage. You're going to have to drag us out of here. We have a lawful permit. We are peacefully demonstrating.
You had two large groups protesting here in Charlottesville on Saturday, Unite the Right and then counter-protesters. The Unite the Right group included David Duke, who's a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan, and Richard Spencer, who coined the term alt-right. But most of those who came to what was formerly known as Lee Park were young white men. Some of them had flags with the Nazi swastika on them. Others waved the old Confederate flag, representing the old South and the time of slavery. And many of them were heavily armed. They had handguns and holsters at their waists and semi-automatic rifles. It was quite a sight. We still don't have crowd estimates from the police, so we don't know how many there were. I would just guess from eyeballing the protest, there were a few hundred men there for Unite the Right, and more than 1,000 counter-protesters. The counter-protesters were also a mixed bunch. You had some very gentle people handing out flowers and giving hugs. You had a lot of people in the middle who were shouting and were angry, but certainly did not want to be violent. And then you did have a bit of fight, I would say, in a group called Antifa. That's short for anti-fascist. These are mostly young people who feel very, very strongly that this country has to change very, very radically. And they were certainly prepared to defend themselves.
Sandy Houseman. Christian Picciolini is an unusual witness. He's a former neo-Nazi who now runs an organization called Life After Hate, which tries to educate people about the dangers of violent far-right groups.
I was involved from 1987 to 1995, from the time I was 14 years old to the time I was 22 years old. I was a member of America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group. What we used to call, white supremacists, and we often associated with skinheads or Ku Klux Klan, and they were very easy to spot, very easy to identify when they were in your presence. However, now, and this is due to a concerted effort that we started 30 years ago, because we recognized that the average American racist was being turned off by our shaved heads and our swastika tattoos. So we recognized back then that we needed to change our profile, that we needed to grow our hair out and stop waving swastika flags and instead go to college campuses and enroll and recruit there and join the military to get training and become law enforcement officers and even run for office. So what I'm seeing now is the normalization of what we were back then. It's starting to become part of our socio-political discussion every day. And I think that that's because the way it's become normalized, these people look like our teachers, our doctors, our mechanics, our lawyers, our dentists. And it's so hard to distinguish. And people have become so fearful of how many people might exist in this movement because they can't readily identify them. So if I were to estimate, I couldn't. It's gotten to the point where they've become invisible.
Christian Picciolini, if there's one group on the far right that you're likely to have heard of, it's the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK. But what about other groups which now make up the far right and believe in white supremacy? J.M. Berger is a fellow at the International Centre for Counterterrorism at The Hague and is an expert on extremism. He joins me from Cambridge, Massachusetts. J.M. Berger, what sort of numbers are we talking about with the American far right?
It's pretty unclear. I mean, in terms of the actual number of people who have some kind of organizational affiliation or are going to show up for an event, what we've seen up until now is that those numbers are very small. In fact, as far as early 2016, efforts to put together a white nationalist day of protest nationwide generated, maybe 15 or 20 people in different locations. And what we've seen since then is that the numbers of people they can turn out are steadily rising. And so Charlottesville is kind of a high water mark for any kind of recent event.
Just talk us through the history of the far right since World War II, briefly.
Well, it's a very complex history because there are a lot of different factions. There was a rising right-wing movement in the post-World War II era that often revolved around anti-communism. What we've really seen is that there are many small groups competing with each other and that they often have very different orientations and beliefs. So there are overtly white nationalist groups. Some come out of the KKK kind of lineage. Others have more of a religious thrust. Some, very early on, as Christian was saying, some of them really noticed that they couldn't sell what they were trying to sell to the American public and started trying to come up with different, more sanitized ways to present themselves. While at the same time, you had other groups like the American Nazi Party that really were very focused on the pageantry and the display. So we've really seen there's just a multitude of these groups, and it's been difficult for them to operate in a coordinated way until now.
And if they have any one thing in common, what would it be?
Well, it's all about defining and defending some kind of identity. But when we talk about the far right, we're talking about, really moving from the spectrum of pure white supremacy or the desire to even kill all people who are not white, all the way to a group of people who believe the government is corrupt and needs to be overthrown by military force. And those groups often specifically renounce racism, but, in fact, their membership is very conflicted on the issue. So we see a lot of these on the anti-government end of the spectrum. A lot of these groups will formally renounce racist beliefs. But, when you look at the base and you look at what members are talking about, there's often a lot of overlap.
Now, many of us here were taken aback by the sight of the heavily armed men walking around in combat dress with semi-automatic weaponry, looked like the army or something like this. We don't have anything like this in the UK. Who were those people?
Some of them are overt white supremacists. Neo-Nazis were present there and heavily armed. There were also some people from more the anti-government wing. And interestingly, a couple of people who were at this event were associated with one particular branch called the 3% Patriots, which is an anti-government militia. And after Charlottesville, they put out a fairly strong statement saying, stay away from these neo-Nazi guys. They're tarnishing our movement. So, we may see some additional shifting in how these alliances work.
And that we also heard Christian Picciolini talk there about the normalization of these people or some of their ideas. Are their ideas actually becoming more acceptable than they were? Do they have a kind of large area around the fringe that they represent?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, yes. I think, you can attribute that pretty directly to two factors. One is social media. It does have an amplifying effect. If you look at the media back in the 1990s, there were gatekeepers, really, to sort of kept any really fringe person from getting a huge following. You couldn't really broadcast a white nationalist message and reach 100,000 or 200,000 people. The second factor is the candidacy and now the presidency of Donald Trump. He is emboldening these guys and he's amplifying a lot of what they're trying to convey.
Let's take some of this up, and that's the history and the who. So now for the what and the how. What is the scale and the threat of the far right, and how should American society respond? Joining me and J.M. Berger to discuss this, Leonard Zeskind, who runs an organisation called the Institute for Education and Research for Human Rights. He's based in Missouri, in Kansas City, Missouri, and he's an expert on the far right. Asha Rangappa is a former special agent with the FBI and now teaches at Yale Law School, amongst others, and she's on the line from Yale University. And let me ask you all this question to start off with. Leonard Zeskind, was Charlottesville a one-off, or is it the start of something bigger?
This was the third demonstration in Charlottesville. There were two previous demonstrations aimed at keeping the Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson statues in Charlotte. And so this is not a one-off, and they're promising more. Most previous demonstration was by some Ku Klux Klan members who had 50 people who were completely shouted down by the crowd, and no violence occurred, and so forth. Richard Spencer started this. Spencer was a former student at the University of Virginia. He now runs the National Policy Institute, and he's a white nationalist in his ultimate goals. That is, he wants to carve a white nation state out of the United States. What we're going to see in the near future is a lot of activity all across the country, from Houston to Boston, Seattle to Atlanta, and Charlottesville is a piece of that, and it's an important piece. What it showed us was a generational shift in the white nationalist world, white supremacist world. What we're seeing now is the emergence of leaders like Spencer, Matt Heimbach, and people of that younger generation.
Asha Rangappa, what do you think about Charlottesville as a harbinger of things to come?
Well, domestic terrorism is a larger threat to the United States than radical Islamic terrorism. There have been more terrorist incidents in the U.S. that have been perpetuated by domestic groups than by Islamic groups are associated with ideologies located abroad. So it's definitely a growing trend. The issue is that the way that we deal with these two different categories, we use different tools for them. And that's going to be an issue moving forward.
Okay. And I very definitely want to come back to precisely that point in a moment. Linda Zeskind, is there something about the way in which demographics is changing in the U.S. that gives rise to this?
You betcha, Red Ryder. You betcha. These people today, these youngsters are coming in. They believe that white people are going to disappear, which is silly, but they believe that correctly that white people will be a demographic minority in the United States in the near future, certainly within their lifetime, and they'll be a minority among other minorities. And they don't want to get along. They don't want to share. They want exclusive political power for themselves.
Jane Berger, just how dangerous do you think the far right in America now is?
Potentially very dangerous. What we've seen up until now is that there's been a lot of talk and a lot of preparation in right-wing circles. They train, they arm themselves, and they have been slow to act until now. And what we're seeing is a greater frequency of action, and we're seeing a greater willingness to take lives, sometimes many lives at once. So I think that we're looking at a rising threat unless something significantly reverses it soon.
On the question of Obama and Trump, I've seen it written both ways. That Obama is the reason why the far right has been energized. And then I've seen it written that Trump is the reason why the far right has been energized. How would you accord weight to these?
There's clearly the rise of the Tea Party movement in opposition to Obama played a big role in setting the stage for what we're seeing now. I think that when we talk about who's responsible, I think that, you know, Obama's responsibility lies in his having the temerity to be black, whereas Trump's responsibility lies in his explicit rhetoric in support of nativists, often specifically nodding to white nationalists.
So in a way, one is a provocation and the other is an encouragement. They work, in a sense, together. There's a sort of relationship there.
Yes, if you consider it a provocation to be born with a certain skin color. Yes.
Well,
the
obviously
growth in the white nationalists, however, occurred in the last years of the Obama administration. It was not started by Trump. It was at the tail end of Obama's administration, after the Tea Party had had their say, and the white nationalists came back, and it was the younger leadership in the white nationalist movement, the people who had not been part of the 80s and the 90s in this movement, and they're the ones who are pioneering these new developments.
Asha Rangappa, can I ask you this about how America should tackle the far right? I mean, looking again at the people at Charlottesville, the weapons and so on, well, we in Britain, we've seen the films with the FBI agents and so on, and we imagine the FBI are all over these people and kind of, you know, got the wires on them and know what they're doing, can stop them. Is that true?
FBI. No, the FBI is very limited in kind of how it can respond to this. So, you know, these are ultimately political groups that are ostensibly engaging in political and First Amendment activity. So
the First Amendment is the protection of freedom of
expression.
Is the
protection of freedom of speech. So they can't conduct the kind of counterintelligence or counterterrorism investigations that they can do against international terrorist organizations. The FBI actually has a checkered past on this front. Under Hoover, the FBI did engage in spying operations on the KKK and attempts to disrupt them, along with operations against Communist Party, Vietnam protesters, civil rights leaders. So all of these were exposed. There were congressional hearings. And what came out of those hearings is something called the Attorney General Guidelines, which govern the way the FBI can do their investigations. And having been an agent, I can tell you that anything that will start to get near First Amendment activity, it raises the bar for the investigation. So for most of these groups, they have to cross the line into criminal activity. I mean, it could be a conspiracy to commit criminal activity. They don't actually have to carry it out. But it is approached from a criminal angle and is typically reactive.
Isn't this rather frustrating for people like the FBI? Because having to wait for the moment when they have the justification to even investigate these people?
Yes, it can be frustrating. And I would say that typically what, you know, the tools that are used with these groups are civil rights laws that criminalize certain kinds of behavior against other groups, like hate crimes laws. Though we use the term domestic terrorism, they're not treated as terrorist groups the way that we treat other terrorist groups.
Yeah, so what then for is the Department of Homeland Security for, if it's not to look into people like this?
The Department of Homeland Security is really conducting a broader view of the kinds of threats that exist within the United States. Now, it does have a program called Countering Violent Extremism that's supposed to kind of broadly monitor the growing threats within the United States. Though after the Trump administration took over, white supremacist groups or extreme right-wing hate groups were taken off the list of the kinds of groups that would be monitored.
Why?
By the Department of Homeland Security. It was determined by the Trump administration that the focus should be on Islamic extremism exclusively.
Jane Berger, I mean, since you've dealt with looking at ISIS and other groups like that, what do you make of that order of priorities on part of the Trump administration?
After 9/11, I think the thing that we took away from that, and it's not incorrect to take away from that, is that jihadist terrorists are very focused on mass casualty attacks. And it's not that we never see that coming from the far right in this country, but we see jihadist extremists much more often sort of mobilize incredible plots to kill a lot of people at one time. So there is a certain logic to prioritizing that. But the counter to that is that there are vastly more people who fall into the category of right-wing extremists in the United States than there are people who fall into the category of jihadist extremists. So if those people start to mobilize, and maybe Charlottesville is a sign that they are, if they start to mobilize toward violence, the potential threat that from domestic right-wing extremism is much greater than anything that credibly could be mounted by a jihadist group, with the exception of nuclear terrorism.
Leonard Zeskind.
In the immediate aftermath of the bombing in Oklahoma City of the federal building, the FBI cracked down on the militia groups. They put the militia groups that were all over the country, there were a number of cases, they put them out of business. But fighting this emergent white nationalism is going to have to be finally, and I agree with both of the previous speakers, it's finally a citizen and residents' responsibility to stand up for decency and democracy. And if they can do that, we'll put this white nationalism to the side.
Jan Berger, is there a danger that we're overplaying all this? I mean, sometimes when you see interviews with these people or discussions with these people, it's, I can only kind of describe it as rather kind of pathetic. They're rather pathetic, and you've said there aren't very large numbers of them. Are we sort of transfixed by something like Charlottesville and giving them more prominence than in fact they deserve?
There aren't very large numbers of people who are mobilized right now, but there are potentially very large numbers of people who are supportive of that mobilization. And I think when we see some of the polling over the next couple of weeks, we'll get a better sense of how what the size of that is. I don't think we're overplaying it. I think this is a crisis for our country, and I think we really need to confront it.
White people, anti-racist, democratic-minded people in this country are standing in, at a crossroads. They have to decide whether they're going to sit by and let the white supremacist spasm of growth grow, or whether they're going to stand up to it in a peaceful and democratic fashion. And I think that that has yet to be determined. I think discussions like this are very, very useful, that we need to have more. Everywhere in the country now, we're talking about Confederate symbols. Everywhere in the country, they're flying the Confederate flag at Tea Party rallies in Seattle, Washington. They're protecting the Confederacy as a symbol of white resistance, not a question of tradition. We're discussing that. Wonderful. And we've got to discuss it more, and we've got to come up with a strategy to meet this new spasm of activity by the white nationalists in an appropriate fashion. We haven't done that yet. We will, I hope, but it's not that easy to do.
Jan Berger,
we're going to have trouble before we get it fixed.
I mean, it seems to me, given that you have people who've got a lot of guns and a lot of hatred around, wouldn't it take some kind of, you know, I mean, if some of these guys were actually to use their guns in some of these events, couldn't you have a disaster which itself would be the spark of many much worse things to come? Isn't that what the government and the authorities should be worried about? Jan Berger.
Certainly there is the potential for something very bad to happen. Now, you know,
it's already
one thing
happened.
That happened. I mean, in terms of like, I mean, in terms of a large scale act of violence that really sets off something. We may be already on that path. You know, I think that we have to be concerned about it. Now, if there's like an Oklahoma City scale attack, that could cut two ways with the movement. I mean, it could send a lot of people back home. People don't always, terrorism is a double-edged sword, and people don't always respond well to it. You know, it can quiet a movement down rather than mobilizing it further. But, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty right now, I think.
So let me ask you all three a very quick question to end up with. Looking forward 2-3 years' time, to the time of the next presidential election, do you think we're still going to be talking about the far right in a big way by then, or do you think it will have passed over? Leonard Zeskind.
I think we will. Probably not like we are now, because unfortunately Americans have a short memory. But there are a number of these activists who have already declared themselves Senate candidates and political candidates. And they ran people for office in the last election. They always have trouble running in elections. I'll still be talking about it, and I'll still be working with people who want to combat it. So it depends on where you are. In Boston, you don't need to do this. But in Kansas City, in Alabama, in Virginia, in North Carolina, you bet your red rider, we're going to be having to deal with this.
Asha Rangappa.
Yes, I definitely think that we'll still be talking about it. I think that these movements are growing not just here, but all over Europe. I think that whether it's here or in other countries, they're going to continue to be visible. And I think as long as Donald Trump is president, he's always going to be confronted with, you know, reactions to these issues. My guess is he's not going to respond the way that people want. That creates more conversation around it. And then I think, again, the underlying issues of race in this country, I mean, they're just not going to go away. Those issues, every time there's something that creates a civil rights issue, a hate crime that becomes very visible, is going to bring all of these questions back up to the surface again.
And Jan Berger.
I think we're definitely going to be talking about it. I'm not sure how we're going to be talking about it. I have generally been and tried to maintain some optimism about the direction that these things are going in, and my optimism is being sorely tested at the moment. So I'm in a wait-and-see mode right now.
Well, thank you all very much. To sum up on this, the far right in America are small, but they're growing, they're dangerous, and the government doesn't really have a strategy for dealing with them. My thanks to Leonard Zeskind, Asha Rangappa, J.M. Berger, Sandy Houseman and Christian Picciolini. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Jim Frank. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.